The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
We're going to look at two passages in the New Testament and then two passages in the Old Testament. In Romans 15, verse 4, it says, "For everything was written in the past, for everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through endurance and encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope." And then I want to look at 1 Corinthians 10, starting at verse 6. And I'm reading out of the NIV. 1 Corinthians 10, 6. "Now these things," which he had just talked about, which was the exodus of Israel from Egypt, "now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, 'The people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry.' We should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 of them died. We should not test the Lord as some of them did and were killed by snakes. And do not grumble as some of them did and were killed by the destroying angel. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man, and God is faithful. He will not let us be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, He will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it." Some of you don't have handouts. At the end, I'll make some more if you want them. One thing's really clear from these New Testament passages, and that is that there is some kind of value to knowing about the past. And I think it's also clear from a couple of passages in the Old Testament. Let's look at Deuteronomy 6. And this particular one, I don't think I'm going to read it to you, but I just want you to look at it yourselves later on. It's a little bit, it's the whole chapter, really. And it says that that we are supposed to remember and remind ourselves, and we're to remind those that come after us about the mighty deeds that God has done. And the whole chapter deals with that, and I'm not going to read that. Just want to comment on that. And then I want to look at Joshua and read two verses there. In Joshua 4, verses 6 and verse 21. "So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and he said to them, 'Go over before the ark of the Lord your God.'" I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong verse. Verse 6. He told them to take these stones into the river, and then verse 6, "to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever." And then in verse 21, "Joshua said to the Israelites, 'In the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, "What do these stones mean?" tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground.'" In both cases, in both the Old Testament and in the New, it's clear that there is real purpose in us knowing what happened in the past. In fact, in a very real sense, we could say that all of the Bible is history, and that it has a purpose, the history that is in the Bible. I'd also suggest that God has continued to work among His people. We better hope that He has. And that church history also has a significance, and that for that reason it's immensely valuable to us. Now there's a definite warning. The history that we have here was chosen and selected by God, and the way that it was delivered to us was decided by God. And so it has God's seal of approval. Church history is a little different. We have to be really careful, really cautious as we're studying church history, because although God has been at work among His people, history that's been written down since the close of the New Testament is man's presentation of it. And so man is not infallible. So when we read church history outside of the New Testament, we have to be very careful how we evaluate it and how we use it. But it is important, and so we shouldn't let that worry us. We need to know history, or we shouldn't let it worry us in the wrong sense so that we think we can't use history, that it can't be valuable to us. We need to know history both so that we can answer questions when they are asked. Now that's what Deuteronomy 6 is about. When your children ask these questions, you need to be able to tell them the reason. Why do you do this? Why? Now in the Old Testament, they were various things that the Israelites did because of what the law said to do. And so in Deuteronomy 6, they were told to be ready to tell their children the reason that they did these things. And essentially that was saying, you have to know your history. Why is it that we practice these various things? We also need to know history to encourage, we also need to encourage a sense of history so as to stimulate the proper asking of questions. And that's what Joshua chapter 4 talks about. There was a specific monument was raised up, and it would cause the children, the young people, whoever, to ask questions. Why are these stones here? They must have some special meaning. So we have an obligation, I think, from the Scriptures, both to understand and know our own history so that when we're asked questions, we can say more than, I don't know. And we should also develop and encourage a sense of history so that, and this means by doing certain things, doing special things, so that questions are stimulated or elicited from the young people. There is something worth passing on, and if nobody asks about it, it won't get passed on, or at least not so well. And if we can't answer the questions when we do pass things on, then they won't stick as well either, I think. I think it's important for all of us to know a certain amount of history, and I think it's very practical. Now, it doesn't mean all of us have to be historians, but you know, I think one thing that you need to be able to do is to know and be able to express your own history. And that means, how did you come to be where you're at? How did you come to know the Lord? How did you come to be where you're at? Now, I was raised Catholic, and so part of my history is how I became what I am now, which isn't Catholic. But so all of us have our own personal history, and we should think about that, we should be able to express that, we should know the why of it. But it goes beyond that. I think it's very good for us to understand our congregation's history. After all, you're going to be working with young people, and each one of your congregations has a reason for being and for being the way it is, and it would be good for you to know a little bit about that. Now, I'm not saying you have to know a whole lot. I think it's also good for us to have an awareness of our denomination's history, both in a particular sense, whichever group you're from, and also broadly speaking, in Anabaptism or Mennonite history as a whole. And then finally, I think we ought to know something about the church's broad history. So this is important, and I hope you can see that, because you yourself ought to know about your own history. You ought to be able to tell people how the Lord met you and why you are a Christian. And then it's a step from there. What about my congregation? What about my denomination? And what about the church as a whole? Why are we where we are? And we're part of each one of those things. So it's a very important and practical issue. Sometimes people think history isn't practical, but just think about it. Get personal first. How did you become a Christian? And then all those other steps simply follow from there. And you ought to know a little bit about them. I'm not saying you should know in detail how your congregation went year by year, but you should know a little bit of something about it. Knowing these things, knowing about myself and my church and my broader church and finally the whole church, at least to some degree, as the Scripture told us, warns us about dangers and pitfalls that are before us. Without history, we can't begin to understand either ourselves or others. So this is an important task and one we should take seriously. I want to give a relatively recent event as an example to show how a certain amount of knowledge of church history can bring to light facts and beliefs that otherwise might be just lost in kind of an obscure discussion. How many of you remember the Gulf War in 1990? How many don't remember it? Okay, good. The reason I ask that is maybe a year ago, Steve Brubaker, who works here, it was about a year ago. He said, "Do you realize that none of the 12th graders here at school remember Ronald Reagan?" What he meant was as a president. They may have remembered reading about him, but it was after he was president. None of the 12th graders last year remembered Reagan while he was president. And I was floored, you know, so I wasn't quite sure if everybody would remember the Gulf War in 1990. Well, I did, and I do remember it. And it was kind of intriguing to me. At my church, I was a little bit concerned about some of the response to it. Some people heard and saw what was happening and were kind of amazed at it. You know, America was bombing Iraq, just to put it in, give you the facts, and at a very safe distance. And so there were reporters in Baghdad who actually would see these rockets come in and they would go right to a building and go right through a window and then they'd blow up. So these things were what they call smart bombs. Well, anyway, I was a little bit concerned because there almost seemed to be, at least for some of the young people, a feeling of, wow, look what we can do. And let's face it, these were Americans, so yeah, it's somewhat what we can do. And so this started, we ended up having a little history lesson. It was 10 nights where we talked about non-resistance in the church, the historical perspective, and how the early church was non-resistant and how things changed over time. And to give a perspective, because I think a lot of those people, young people especially, just didn't know why we believed what we were supposed to believe. They didn't know why we supposedly are non-resistant and other Christians weren't. But you know, so if you just take today as it is, and you can have a lot of questions. Why is this man down the street that I really admire as a Christian? He would help anybody. He thinks this is a good idea, this Gulf War. He thinks that we need to get Saddam. And why is the minister getting up and saying that, well, we Christians shouldn't be involved in that, and it's really not a good thing? If you don't know how these different people got to these different places, it can be very confusing. History can put all of that into perspective, and I think that is one of the main importances, that it can show why Christians hold differing positions, and specifically in this example that I've given, why they hold different positions on war and what the role of the Christian is in war. It can help us understand, are all these positions, well, now maybe we've looked at it and we understand why Mr. Smith down the road sees it one way and the minister sees it another way, but are all these positions equally valid? Looking at the scriptures is the final answer, but looking at history can give us the perspective that helps us understand those differences. Church history itself can't answer the questions finally. It takes insight into what God's Word says. It could provide a significant part of the answer, though, by explaining how Christians have viewed this issue at various times and why there are several views now. And so this is just taking one instance, something that happened relatively recently, and yet it caused a lot of questions, at least in the setting that I was in. History is extremely relevant to life today. What other areas can you think of in which history might help us to understand where we are today and why? What kind of, let's just real quick hear some response from you. What other areas might be clarified by looking at what history says, what church history says? Okay, modesty?
Yeah.
Just few. I'm not going to ask you to then tell me about the history of that thing. But what other? I heard
voting.
Okay.
Baptism.
Okay, baptism. Okay. In other words, just about anything could be. We could get a little bit more insight into just about anything that we practice and do and believe if we just look at the history of it. Now, once again, that's not going to give you the final answer. The final answer comes from here. But one thing I want to say is that this isn't necessarily going to tell you why another Christian believes slightly differently. So the word and history really can bring to light why there are these differences. And I think it can help you then to evaluate which of those different points is more correct. If you just look at the scriptures, often we get into this, well, it says here this, and it says somewhere else it says that, and there's you get to no real agreement. I think sometimes that looking at history gives a little bit more clarity on those verses that sometimes seem to conflict. Well, I'm going to discuss a little bit some specifics about approaching church history, at least how I would do it. Now, history is a very human exercise. So just because I say I would do it this way doesn't mean you have to agree with me. But I'm going to tell you how I approach it, and then this will give you some things to think about, even if it's to disagree strongly with. One of the things that I think is very important is that we need to recognize that there are issues which unite all Orthodox Christians as well as issues which divide. And I think sometimes as we approach church history, we approach it from the viewpoint of us against them. Now, there are real differences, and these differences are important. And with the very example that I gave you, that was a very important issue, and the differences are very important, and what is right is very important to me. But I do think that sometimes we maybe forget something that's also important, and that is that there's something that unites all Orthodox Christians. That's one reason when Mr. Smith disagrees with me about war, I'm a little bit taken aback, because there's certain things that we agree with each other on very strongly, and we ought to. Otherwise, one of us is not quite in the right boat as far as what it means to be Orthodox. So there are differences, and I'm not underplaying those. In fact, I want to talk about those in a little bit. But I think it's important for us not to lose sight of the fact that there are real things that unite believers all the way around the world and throughout history, in all time and in all places. As far as the historical developments go, that aspect of history which illuminates our unity is the development of the creeds. And I gave you some handouts, and I didn't keep one. I think it's on the back of this one that says handout one. There's a handout that shows what's called the Nicene Creed. Is that on the back of one? Yeah. Okay, on the back of handout one, there is something called the Nicene Creed. And probably most of you have seen one of these. This is the Mennonite Confession of Faith, where I joined church. They gave us one of these when we were in the instruction class, and it has a lot of very important and good documents. And one of them, right at the very beginning, well, there's a brief historical outline of the church, but then right after that, there is, well, 17. There is the Apostles' Creed. And that is simply one of the creeds that the churches, that Christians all throughout history have held to as those basic foundational concepts or beliefs that all of us must hold to. Now, I gave a copy of the Nicene Creed for a specific reason. The very fact that the Apostles' Creed is listed in the Mennonite Confession of Faith, which is put out by Rod and Staff, says that something like this is okay. The reason I gave you the Nicene Creed is it's very similar to the Apostles' Creed, but it's more widely accepted. The Apostles' Creed is basically held to by Christians in the West, whereas the Nicene Creed is held to by Christians in the East and the West. And so I personally, they're both good, and they both say the same thing. But this one is something that Christians all over the world will recognize. And what that does is, the creed says, here are the things that we know we can agree about, we can agree together about God, who Jesus is, what the church is, what man's need was, and how God took care of that. And it says, you know, these are the specific reason the Nicene Creed was written was to say, what are the boundary lines outside of which a person is not really an Orthodox Christian or someone who has beliefs that are not proper? And it leaves a whole lot of things untouched, but there's a reason for that. There are a whole lot of things that, at least in the early church when this was compiled, there was a disagreement about. What I want to hit at and hammer at is that the creed, whether it's the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, says these are things that all Christians, Orthodox Christians, believe in. Who God is, who Jesus is, what He did for us, what our need was, and what the result of what He did for us was. It doesn't go into a whole lot of detail, but it says some of those very important things. One thing it says, without using the word, is that we believe God is Trinity. That God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, it doesn't use the word. It tries to be as biblical as possible. Now, what I'm saying is, we need to recognize that there are things like this that tie us all together. Whether you're Anabaptist or Baptist or even Catholic or Orthodox, these are things that Christians have throughout history believed. And sometimes, like I say, we kind of hit on the places where we disagree and forget about the places we agree. So I think it's important not to forget that, to remember that there are some things that bring us together. Those who don't agree with what the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed says insist on their own insights. These are things that the church has accepted from day one. Now, they were put together at specific times, but they're accepted from day one. Most of them are just phrases from out of the New Testament. But those who disagree with this, they insist on following their own insights. And there's a name for that, and if you don't believe me, you can look it up in the dictionary, and that's heresy. Heresy is following your own opinion. It's quite literally the Greek word for your own opinion. And these creeds are statements that the church throughout all time has said. These are the sort of the foundational, basic facts that we all agree on. We have a lot of other disagreements, but these are the things we agree on. So, I think it's important to recognize that there's something that brings us together, and tell your students about that. There are also a lot of things that we disagree on, and once again, we can go back to this little booklet, the Mennonite Confession of Faith. And right after the Apostles' Creed, it has the Schleitheim Confession and it has the Dordrecht Confession. One thing I would emphasize is that there's something that brings us together as believers. It's the creeds. The creeds are taken from the Scriptures and they say how we look at the Scriptures. Now, if you don't believe me, go talk to a JW. J.W. uses the Scriptures too, but he has a different way of approaching it. The creed says how we approach it. We approach it as looking at it as the Father, the Son, and the Spirit being one God, and caring for man and sending Christ, who is also God, to die for us. So it says something about our approach to the Scriptures. But there are places where we disagree, and the confessions that are in this little booklet make those things clear. There are places that are very important. We disagree with other Christians, and you will find them very well described in both the Schleitheim and the Dordrecht Confession. Okay, how should a person proceed when he's teaching history? It's important to get into your own head how you see the big picture. Now, I'm going to give a little bit of my understanding of it, but in the end, the issue is, you've got to get it in your head. How do I see this? How do I understand the big picture? What's the overview of history that you want to make clear to your students? If you don't know what you want to make clear to them, then you won't. You've got to get it in your head. Just as in a person's life, we can see in history periods with various emphases. So, a person when he's a child is taken care of. When he's growing up a little bit older, he's starting to learn to be independent. Then finally he's independent. Usually gets married. I'm single for those of you that don't know. So usually they get married and have children and a family of their own and so on. The church has periods like that too that we can identify. Now, this is a human endeavor, so there can be differences of opinion how to do this, but I think it's pretty well accepted that we can see changes and development in the church. And so what I'm saying is, you get in your head how you understand this, and then you'll know what you want to present to your students. One thing that I think would be good for you to do is to read several approaches and think through for yourself how you see it. Obviously, if you're using a history book, one that I'm going to suggest for consideration anyway for Mennonite history is Through Fire and Water. Okay, obviously this author is going to have his way of viewing Anabaptist history. The same thing if you take any other particular history book. The one that we use here is called The Church in Plain Language. And it's quite obvious. All you have to do is look at the table of contents and you'll see what the author's overview is. I think it'd be good for you to maybe read more than one, at least look at more than one, to get a feel for some different ways of understanding it, because none of them is inspired. Then with each period, once you've got your understanding of this, once you have in your mind how you want to look at this, then it's good for you to think about somebody who's sort of illustrates that period. And you can look at handout two. I have a periodization that I sort of what the one I follow. And this is not the one necessarily. This isn't necessarily for you or how you might do it best. But this is a way of looking at it. I have four major ages or periods in the church, and then I've broken each one of those down into several, except for the Reformation. And the dates are sort of general. There's nothing divinely inspired about this, like I said, and so there's going to be some overlap. And in fact, two of them overlap each other, and you'll see that in just a second. But get it in your head. How do you understand what has happened in church history? How do you see the various periods? Get that into your mind. And then I think to help the students, it would be good to find somebody that kind of illustrates this time period. And for each one of these, I've given a name. Now, you don't have to follow that name. You can think of someone else that illustrates this, and that'll be fine. Also, get into your mind what the flavor of that particular time was. That's going to help you get across to the student. That's what you want him to understand, what the flavor of that particular period or time was. And what I have here is Ignatius for the Apostolic Church from 1 to 100. Now, you might want to put one of the writers of the Scriptures. I figured we all know that pretty well, so I went for somebody who's who was outside of the New Testament during that period. And then under each one of these, I've written down something anyway about the flavor of the time. And it may not be everything, and it may not even be, in your mind, the most important thing. But you have to kind of come to your understanding. What do I see as the most important thing here? We'll just go over this real quick, and then I'll say another thing that I would do with these people. The Apostolic Church, up to 100, was a time of organization and growth throughout the Roman Empire, growth of the church. Then the church experienced persecution roughly from 100 to 300. The person that I put was Origen. And during this time, the church continued to grow even as conflict arose between loyalty to Caesar and loyalty to Jesus. Because of the conflict and loyalty, the state began to persecute the church. We see this particular time or this particular problem even in the New Testament, because the issue between the early church and the Roman Empire was the Romans wanted to make sure that their people saw Caesar as Lord. Caesar's the top person in the empire. And so motto was Caesar is Lord. And already we see that reflected in the New Testament because the church said Jesus is Lord. And there was an inevitable clash that was going to occur and did occur. And it was at the heart of the persecution the church experienced. Then there was toleration and acceptance. That was from 300 to 600. And this is, I think, a very interesting time. I put Augustine down as the person to look at especially. And it was a time when the state started first to tolerate the church. And then as time went on, the church grew in its influence and power. Some people say that when Constantine tolerated the church, that church and state were wedded together. I would argue with that, but it's not the time to do that right now. What happened at first, I would say, is that the state simply tolerated the church with a certain amount of approval and acceptance, and that grew over time until finally the two indeed did become, so to speak, wed together with very unfortunate results. The medieval church, there were several periods there. There was a period of struggle and consolidation. This is from a class that I taught here for the TAP students. So you would probably want to think of a little bit different way of expressing this maybe for your students. But you can get the idea anyway, the flavor. Struggle and consolidation from 400 to 1000. And I have two people that I think were important. And these aren't necessarily the most important or the only important ones, but they give something about this flavor that I want to emphasize. And they are Charlemagne and Muhammad. And this was a period in which there was confusion and chaos. But during that period, the church was the only continuous institution that went on and held society together, at least to a degree. And it's also during this time that the church increasingly gave direction and stability, at least to Europe. But Charlemagne and Muhammad are sort of two sides of the coin. On the one side, Charlemagne represents what was happening as far as the church and state growing closer together and bringing a certain kind of stability. And Muhammad, on the other side, was one of the factors that brought chaos and instability. And so that's how I would approach that. But now you would find what would meet your needs, what meets the overview that you have developed. Next, the Christian Society from 1000 to 1500. I have St. Francis of Assisi. And this became the ultimate expression of the union between society and the church. And this was a time when at least your average European would have seen the church, the state, society, everything blended together in a harmonious one. And you couldn't imagine one without the other. And so that's something that you need to, at least I would say, you need to help your students see and understand. It's so different than what our experience of society and church and state and all those things would be today. So it's very foundational in the development of the church. Then something that we all know is very important, the Reformation from 1500 to 1600, and those are just relatively rounded dates. Actually, I'd make it go a little further than 1600, but I'm just using rounded dates. And for the two personages, I have Luther and Loyola. Luther, of course, we know who he is. He sparked the Reformation, and Loyola would be from the other side, the Catholic response. And I think that it's important for you to get that across your students that this wasn't just a one-sided affair. There were two ways of looking at what happened then. And as the church loses its way, you can tell where... Well, no, even a Catholic would agree with that. As the church loses its way, the demand for reform and a return to the foundation of the church grows. Several different streams arise out of this time, and they're what we know. Anabaptism, Anglicanism, Calvinism, which is also called Reformed, Lutheranism, and Tridentine or Reformed Catholicism. Catholicism, as you know it today, is different than it was during the medieval times, and it would be good to make that clear, too, to the students, that things have changed. It's not quite the same church or quite the same experience today as it would have been before and during the Reformation. Finally, the modern church, I broke that down into two periods, the Enlightenment, 1600 roughly to 1800, and Pascal and Voltaire. Pascal was a defender of Christianity. Voltaire, one of his famous quotes is, in French, écrase la femme, which is wipe out the infamous thing, which was the church. Rub the church out, in other words, erase it, get rid of it. He was obviously not a Christian. Parts of society at this time begin to reject the control and direction of the church and demand freedom for the pursuit of knowledge. And that is why it's called the Enlightenment. Then finally, revival, missions, and liberalism from 1800 till today. And there are a whole lot of possibilities here of people that you could use as illustrating what was going on. I chose Wesley because of revival, but you could choose a whole lot of people because of missions, for instance. You can choose someone from our tradition. There are people, a lot of people available. I just chose Wesley because at the beginning of this period, revivalism became important, and Wesley was important in that. And then coming a little bit closer to today and where we specifically are as people today, the church, the country, the society, Darwin or Freud, and or Freud, this period is a time of increasing conflict between those rejecting the direction of the church and those emphasizing, those rejecting the direction of the church and those emphasizing man's freedom on one side. That conflict grows between them and the church. However, at the same time, the church experiences revival and probably the fastest growth it experienced, except at the very beginning, because of missions and because of revivalism. So this is what I'm telling you that you need to do for yourself. You shouldn't follow this. You should read at least, I'd say, two histories and get a real feel for this. What do you see happening? And then I think this is an approach that makes it easier for the student to grasp and understand. If you have it broken down into periods and you have specific people and specific flavors for those periods, something that they can really get a hold of, I think that's helpful. I'm going to real quick give you... there's one other thing you should do as far as with these people... I think it would be really good if you come up with somebody that you can find a good story about. Now, you're teaching younger people, and a good story will help them remember. Now, I have for the period of persecution, Origen, and I'm going to give you him as an example. It's a little bit humorous, but you can tell the story, and I think the humor will actually help them remember it. Origen lived, he was born in the late 100s. I don't remember the exact date, but he would have been, I think it was around 190. And he was born to parents who were Christian. They had converted, at least the father had converted from paganism. And so we're talking around the year 200. There was a persecution. He lived in Egypt, and there was a persecution right around 207 in Egypt. Now, at this point, Origen was just a teenage fellow. I think he's about 17 at this point. And his father was taken by the state authorities and imprisoned. The reason was he had originally been a pagan. And the state began to in this particular persecution, the different persecutions are different, but in this particular persecution in Egypt, the state was persecuting those who switched from paganism to Christianity. If you were born to Christian parents, you were not under threat. So Origen himself was not under threat. His father, however, had converted, and so his father had been taken a prisoner, thrown in jail, and eventually was executed. Origen wanted to go and be with his father. Now, the state, if you insisted, would be glad to execute you, even if you hadn't converted from paganism to Christianity. But it wasn't looking for these people. And so Origen could have joined his father, both in prison and in death. His mother, however, had other ideas, and the story goes that she hid all of his clothes so that he couldn't go be with his father. And so she basically saved his life. Something like that, I think, might help your students remember a couple things. They'll remember the story, and hopefully then they'll remember some things that you can bring out. These persecutions weren't all the same. And not everybody at every time was under danger. You could be a Christian and be totally safe sometimes, you know, and that's not quite the image we have. And yet, if you tell that story, I think it might help them remember several things, and some of them being, you know, what was it like during persecution? Well, you can tell them other things about other persecutions, and that one story might help them kind of hold the whole thing together. At least I think it can work that way. And for each one of these periods, you can find someone that has a good story that will help them remember. And we could talk about Augustine. There are a lot of good stories about him, but I think that would help your students remember, be interested and remember what's being taught. Now, another thing that can be helpful as you're going through these periods and trying to get the student to get a grasp of it is use songs, just like we did at the beginning. Use songs, use art, and use architecture. Now, I want to say a little bit more about songs, but before I do that, I just want to say, if you have access to the internet, you can find some very interesting pictures there that you can share with your students. And I taught church history for the TAP students last spring, and so I found some pictures that I wanted them to see. The reason is they were useful in illustrating what other Christians outside of our tradition believe and how they practice. And so this is a picture, an icon of the Last Supper from an Ethiopian church. And there's a whole lot of things you can discuss about that. You can see right away that it's a little different than the one you're going to see on your living room wall, if you have one. And then there was a picture of an Orthodox church, which could give you a way of discussing, well, how do these people worship? What do they see as important in worshiping? And you can develop out of these pictures some of those kinds of discussions. Also, architecture. The church in each one of these periods had a different way of expressing itself in architecture. In the first periods, there were no churches. There were house churches. And you can find out about that. You can discuss that. What might that mean? Then, as time went on, the structure, and there were churches, church houses, the structure changed. And what were these people trying to say by the different way that they built? So their art, their architecture can help. But one thing that maybe hits us more directly, although architecture hits us too, the way we build our churches says something about us. And you think about that. If you want to talk about that later, we could. But anyway, but one thing that we would maybe feel a little bit more at home with would be songs. And for each one of these periods, you can find songs that were written, not necessarily the tunes, but the songs. Now, the Mennonite hymnal has a lot of has songs from throughout the church's history. And you can look up the authors in the back of the book. And let's see, it starts on page 611. And it now you'll have to know where these people, it doesn't tell you when they live necessarily. I don't think it, some of them it does. Some of them it does and some it doesn't. But anyway, you can look up different people that you're aware of and you can use songs from those time periods, and then you can discuss what that means. Now, we're not going to sing this or anything, but this is one that we used, Shepherd of Tender Youth. We sing it. The tune is not ancient. It's modern. But the song itself is from either the late 100s or the early 200s. We don't have an exact date on it. But that you can sing it, and you can discuss what does this have to say about what Christians at this time were singing about, what they saw as important. And sometimes it touches right on the very issues that they were discussing and arguing about. So, and that's something I think that we like. You know, we're into singing, and so I think it's a kind of a something that we like that will also be an eye opener about what was going on at these various times. Now, the song we did sing was "Faith of Our Fathers." What did you all think? What, any response? We sing it all the time. I tell you, you really got you really sang strong when we got to that last line, sort of the refrain, "Faith of Our Fathers." Can't think of it right now. But anyway, that last line, everybody kind of increased their volume, I thought. So it sounded like we were positive about it. Anybody have any remarks on that song?
Sounds like it was a time of persecution.
You're right, exactly. Let me read the first verse and let you and then ask you about the song. This is the original first verse, which is not in in our songbooks. "Faith of our fathers, Mary's prayers, shall win our country back to thee, and through the truth that comes from God, England shall then indeed be free." Okay, can you maybe guess what the historical setting here was? It was a time of persecution. Titus was right. Any other thoughts about what the song originally was? You won't find it in any of the other verses. Yes?
It was written
for the Catholics. Yeah, it was written by a Catholic, and the Catholics in England were persecuted from roughly 1545 till the early 1800s, with a few times that were exceptions. And so it is a song of persecution, and but it's written from quite a different perspective maybe than what we normally have. Even today, I used to be Catholic, and you won't find this verse in a Catholic songbook, but the reason, at least not in America, because it's so specifically about England, and England coming back to Catholicism is what the song is asking for. Okay. some other items that can be considered. I really haven't taught the age group that you're going to be teaching. And so I got a little help thinking through some of these things. But there's some other things I think that you should consider as a teacher. I think this getting a grasp of history yourself, looking at a couple of approaches, and then deciding for yourself, how do you see this? And getting some of these, getting some specific people, getting some specific stories, getting some songs that fit the time, getting a flavor for each one of these periods. I think that will help you, and it will help the students. Then there's some other things that I think could be helpful. Field trips would add interest. Depends on where you live. But if you live near an historical Anabaptist site or information center, there would be an option there of going and I think that would increase the students' interest. Also, you can consider other sites in your area that might not deal with Anabaptism, but would deal with the broader church. And an example, if anybody is from North Carolina, there's Old Salem in Winston-Salem, which is extremely interesting. It's a Moravian village, and it's still has the old buildings from when the Moravians lived together in community. They had big dorms, just like here. And so it's a very different way of life. And just the town, the way the town is laid out, shows you that. And so if you live near where there's a Mennonite Information Center or some kind of
Anabaptist historical site, like in Lancaster County. Those are good things to take your students to. But there are also other ones that affect the broader church that you should consider. Something else that I really strongly urge you to do is go to either a Catholic or an Orthodox service. Now, an awful lot of the church history, as I've shown the periods here, is very much tied in with the kind of church life that Catholics and Orthodox have. And so I think it would really be good for you to go to a Catholic or an Orthodox service. You don't even have to skip your own church service. You can go on a Saturday night. And the thing you should do is contact a priest and find someone who's, well, maybe you should ask someone else first. Where's there a priest around that's real friendly and would like to talk with you? Because I think it would really be good for you to go, experience the service, and then talk with him afterwards and get it, so to speak, from the horse's mouth. Why did you do this? Your students are going to have questions, and you may not be able to answer them as well as he could. And so we did that here. We went to an Orthodox service. Now, if you go to an Orthodox, I think you'd have you'd quicker find a Catholic priest that would be good to talk to than an Orthodox. And I have nothing against the Orthodox, but the ones that I've talked to tend to be, I don't know if they tend to be hard to talk to about. Why do you do this? Well, there's a difference here. By chance, I found an Orthodox church here that has their priest used to be Methodist. And so he's more used to the American approach of talking and arguing and discussing. And whereas most Orthodox priests actually, often they come from the old country and they're just not used to that. So we were very fortunate. He was very open, and so we had a really good time of asking why this, and he didn't feel threatened, and he also knew where we were coming from a little bit more maybe than a Orthodox priest from Greece might have. But I think that that's a real eye-opener to go and experience and compare your worship services. After all, that's a very key thing for all of us, how we approach and worship God. Something else that might be good is to consider getting your students to do research on individuals and then do a first-person presentation. And maybe you could do that too. Maybe you could come into class one day with a monk's robe on, if you could get something like that, and start telling them about Martin Luther as though you were Martin Luther. That's what I mean by first-person presentation. You dig into Martin Luther, and then you come in there and you tell them why you did what you did. And that might be a good thing for the students, each one of them, to pick somebody and to come and tell the students why I did what I did, whatever that is. And there are plenty of people that could be chosen for this kind of a project. And some of you, maybe plays aren't okay, but if they are, in some schools, students have written plays already and given them, and for the parents. And I'd especially encourage you to do that with maybe Anabaptist history. There are two books that I didn't put down on my list. I have a list of books on one of these sheets, and they're just some possible books to read. And two that I didn't put on here, and I regretted it after I did this list. There's one called On Fire for Christ, which is a retelling of stories from the Martyr's Mirror. And it's really good. And some of them are actually in the form of plays already. But I think it would even be more challenging and more exciting for your students, if this is okay, to write their own play and present that. But they could get the story from either from Martyr's Mirror or from On Fire for Christ. And the other one that's really good is Mirror of the Martyrs. And both of them are retellings of stories from Martyr's Mirror, but much easier for us to, for your student today to read and understand. Another thing that I would encourage is getting them to read biographies of these various important church figures. And that's part of what they would do if they did do a first-person presentation. But I think it'd be good, too, to encourage them to do that beyond that. And the thing is that those stories, like I said, you know, if you find a good story for each particular period, it will help them remember. And as they read various biographies about people who were important in the history of the church, it helps the story, the excitement of it, helps them to grasp it and remember it. As I told you earlier, I think it's important to read other histories so that you can get more depth than just what's in the text. If you, on that list of the handout number one, for possible school texts, we sell two here, and this isn't an advertisement, but it's just that we sell two, and they're meant for high school students, and so they don't go into a whole lot of depth. But I think you need to go and read elsewhere and get a little bit more depth. And the ones that I listed in church history and Mennonite history, those are just some possibilities. And if you want to, we could even talk about which of these are best. Now, oh, there is one I really want to emphasize. If you have a particular interest in the Reformation, the third one down, Theology of the Reformation, is excellent. Now, it's not just a history. It has history, but it's, of course, it focuses on theology. But it is in my mind, the fairest book that I have read. It deals with, first of all, it deals with what Europe was like just before the Reformation. Then it talks about Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, and Menno. So it doesn't deal with the Catholic side of the whole issue, but it does deal with the Protestant side, and I think it is the fairest thing I've ever read. I was just amazed. He is fair to everybody. And so if you're interested in that, both for the history and for the theology, that is one I really recommend. As far as the school texts, each one of those is pretty much, well, the first two are general church history, and you can tell that they're written by a Reformed Christian. The one by Voss is probably a little less noticeable. Church and History by Kuyper is very noticeable. But you know, that's not all bad. You want your students to think about the kinds of issues they're going to meet anyway in life, and one of the things they're going to meet is people who don't agree with them. And so having a text, I don't know of any church history text that is written by a Mennonite and that would be completely acceptable. But this is one I think is pretty good for Mennonite history for that age of student. I'd also encourage you to read magazines like either Christianity Today or Christian History. And also, if you do have access to the net, there are some very interesting sites that give a lot of information on history. Some of them give information on what happened today in history, and I really sort of enjoy that because you can come and tell your students that somebody was born today that was important in history or whatever, something that happened. And finally, another thing that's is good is to give slide presentations. I think stories that are interesting stick, and I think pictures stick. Maybe that's not good, but I think it's the truth. And so if you can give a slide presentation, there is a slide presentation that I think is available through Herald Press that's specifically about Mennonite history. But you know, you could do this yourself, or you could get your students to find out what the important issues and events were, and then go look in books and find pictures of those things. And they can take pictures with the right setup that are then slides, and they can give a presentation to the class, or you could do that. And then finally, one last suggestion I have is that it would be good to do a timeline. And I have a timeline. It's handwritten. And on the one side, this is just something I did for something that I was given at church. And so I did this. But anyway, on the one side, there are events that happen in the church, and on the other side, there are political events. And there's one of two possibilities here. Either you could have a timeline that you give to the students, or maybe better, as you are going along, you can work together at discussing what should we put on this timeline. Maybe you'd have a big timeline on the wall, and you'd have it marked off by years, or maybe centuries. And then as you're going along, okay, what are the important things that we should put on here? You could follow this. You could you could have one side for political and non-church type things, and on the other side you could have things that affected the church. And so the thing about a timeline is that it gives them, once again, it's visual. And it gives them something to grab a hold of and remember a little bit better. And I know one person, anyway, that required them to be able to put events on a timeline at the end of the year, the study time. So you can use the timeline many different ways. One, you could work on it with them, develop it with them, and then at the end, it could be part of the test. I would put some things on the timeline, and then I'd have some things that they needed to put on, where they belonged, what year. Now, I want to give you some time for discussion, and I was also supposed to talk about Mennonite history, and I actually, when I copied my notes, I forgot to copy that, but I'll just say a few things about Mennonite history. You're going to follow the same pattern as what I'm suggesting for church history. You need to read it. You need to get in your mind how you're going to break it down. Now, I don't think that time periods work quite as well with Mennonite history. And so maybe you could break it down to before the break with Protestantism, and then the early Anabaptism. And there are several different areas, and each one of those areas had a particular flavor and important people. And so I would look at Southern Germany, Central Germany, Moravia, Switzerland, Holland, and maybe even, we hardly ever talk about this, but there were other Anabaptists who ended up dying out and who were not Trinitarian. And they were especially strong in Poland and Hungary. And so you might even want to talk about that. You might not want to, I don't know, but that's something you need to think through. And I would do the same thing. Find important people, find songs. And I know some of us kind of react to certain aspects of our background, but one evening, I can read German, and one evening I just took an Ausbund, which is the Old Order Amish songbook, and it's the oldest hymnal still in continuous use in the world. And I just read through those songs, and they're really great martyr songs. And so some of those would be good to, well, if you can't sing them, you could talk about them. And so I would just kind of do the same thing. You can get your ideas from what we discussed here, and you have ideas too. And in fact, that's what I want to open up some time for discussion right now. We don't have much, maybe 5 minutes. But what are your thoughts and questions if you have any?
Who wrote it? I know there is a study guide for the Martyr Prayer. Mm-hmm. Do you know much about that? I've heard about it. That's all I heard.
I have seen it. Is that called in the belly of a whale or something? Is that not? That's not it. Say it again. Oh, I think you're right. Faith Worth Dying For. I can't remember. Maybe it might have some up in the store. I can't remember.
There's another one by James Mowry.
Okay, I think that's the one I was trying to say.
Study Guide to Martyrs.
Yeah. And one thing about the Martyrs, that's good. I would encourage that. The Martyr's Mirror, I mean, you don't want to just have that as your one source, because it gets kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but it's kind of black in a way. It's very bright in another way, but it's the kinds of stories that it gives are obviously how Christians have been persecuted throughout time. And that's both a bright story and a black story, but I don't think you want to have just that. You know, it kind of weighs you down a bit. But it's good to do some of that. Okay. Any other thoughts on your part? Well, I think that's what I have for you. So thanks for listening.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.